Good morning, everyone, everywhere. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today, Peter's going to have a wonderful trip back through his childhood where he grew up, that is, Yorkshire, UK.
Yeah, this is very much Peter's program, I guess.
It is Peter's program.
But we're leading off with things that, if they existed, didn't exist in the same place they are now
when
Peter was growing up. In fact, the call to go home for a visit for me and to take Anne with me for a visit was to do with developments in art of the modern era and some new spaces where they're being displayed. And thanks to Yorkshire.com, they told us all about it. They arranged for us to make a visit to the new Hepworth Gallery in Wakefield and the Yorkshire Sculpture Park in Bretton Woods, not far away. And we're going to start off the program with Simon Wallace, who was the founding director of the Hepworth Museum in Wakefield.
And it's there, of course, because that's where Barbara Hepworth
and Henry Moore.
And Henry Moore were both born.
But you'll hear all about that from Simon, who was on board several years before the museum opened. He said he wasn't responsible for the design. That had already been decided. But he's taken it the rest of the way. And then, because at the last minute, Peter Murphy, who's Murray, who's the director of the Yorkshire Sculpture Park, wasn't able to meet us. So I got Simon to go again and tell us about developments there, which also sound pretty exciting.
Yeah. I was there once, and it poured down rain.
Yeah, well, there's more of that story in the interview with Simon.
So we're going to talk about how we were at the Barbara Hepworth studio.
I did that too. That's all in the interview. You're jumping all over me here, and it's all there. So let's hand it over to Peter and Simon Wallace, director of the Hepworth Gallery in Wakefield, Yorkshire. Listeners, you know that On the Menu turns up in some unusual places, but Wakefield, former capital of the former West Riding of Yorkshire, is a place that, you know, you possibly don't have on your radar screen. But here I am today, and I'm here for a very specific reason, because the largest art gallery outside of the City of London in the United Kingdom opened in Wakefield, Yorkshire, just about 4 or 5 months ago. And we're here in Yorkshire, as you know, and we had the opportunity to stop by and say hi to Simon Wallace, who's the director of the museum. And he says, I can't take credit for all of the project, but you can take credit for a lot of it. So tell us, where did you become part of the story?
I arrived in Wakefield also unexpectedly when I told my wife we were leaving London and selling our house and moving our children up to this new part of the world for us. She looked rather surprised too and said exactly the same. Why Wakefield? And the reason that this museum has been built here is people don't really know this widely yet, but Wakefield is the birthplace of modern British sculpture. It's the area in which Barbara Hepworth and Henry Moore, two of the 20th century's most important artists, were born and grew up. And both of those artists and the associated British and continental artists that they were friends and colleagues with have always been of particular interest to me in my curatorial work. My first job as a curator was at the University of Cambridge's art gallery, Kettle's Yard, which is a beautiful gallery with rather a small collection, but many of the artists that we showed at Kettle's Yard are reflected in the collection we have here. And it was an exciting moment to see my art historical interests connected to wanting to work with contemporary artists being brought together in a brand new building.
So it's a brand new building, and it's a very remarkable building with a remarkable architect. And we'll come back in just a second for that. But interestingly enough, listeners, if you're into modern British art or modern European art, you probably associate Barbara Hepworth with St. Ives, where she had a studio for many years, a studio which in fact is in and of itself a museum, the way it would have appeared if she was still living there and working there. Did she do much work in Wakefield, or was this simply her homeland?
Well, she did make early work here. I mean, some of the formative work in her life was made in Wakefield, but she was only here really for the first 20 years of her life. But as a Yorkshireman yourself, you'll know that growing up in this bit of the world is indelibly etched on you.
No question about that. As I say, the connection was a connection I didn't know. Henry Moore, the connection I knew, and it was really a curious connection, because I was telling Simon, when I was a young man not more than probably about 10 years old, one of our favorite excursions was to take the double-decker tram from Leeds city center to Temple Newsom, where there were several very curious looking objects in the ground, large things made out of marble with holes in them. And I must confess, at age 10, I didn't have much appreciation for Henry Moore, who created them. But he's also a very important part of this cultural experience.
He really is. I think it's fascinating that both of these artists grew up with fathers who were engineers. Barbara Hepworth's father was the civic engineer for the old West Riding. That's this area around Wakefield. And Henry Moore's father was a mining engineer. What better background to come from as a sculptor than to have a father with that kind of professional background?
Now, did they actually work together? Did they collaborate?
Moore and Hepworth were always very closely associated with one another. They were friends.
Okay,
Moore was older than Hepworth, but absolutely there was a moment when that dialogue between the two of them and the dialogue with the circle of artist friends they shared was very vital.
Okay, so the fact that there are some similarities in their work isn't a coincidence?
No, not at all.
Now, back to the building itself, which is really quite dramatic. It's not the Guggenheim in Bilbao, but it does make a really definitive architectural statement. Tell us, if you can, why it does that and who created it.
Well, Sir David Chipperfield is the architect of the Hepworth Wakefield. He won the architectural competition that was set up several years before I came. He's now seen as one of the world's most important architects. He got his knighthood from the Queen at the beginning of the year, largely based on the wonderful work he'd done in Berlin at the Neuss Museum, which is an incredible project of historical restoration interwoven with his contemporary architectural aesthetic. And what I love about the building he's created here, and as you said earlier, Peter, it's the largest purpose-built gallery outside of London, is he's created some very, very beautiful gallery spaces that have this wonderful flow through. You're not just going from one hermetically sealed box to another. There's real drama in terms of the proportions of the spaces. The beauty of the light that comes in is absolutely wonderful. It's a very sculptural building in many ways, and one that really thinks primarily about the interior spaces first, and the exterior being a consequence of the interiors he wanted to create.
That's exactly what I was going to say, because it's almost like, if you like, a reverse order for the Guggenheim in Bilbao, which is a magnificent building on the outside, and inside the works of art are relatively minor in importance compared to the ones that are here. So it's almost like Sir David didn't want the exterior to be a distraction.
I think that's exactly it. I mean, the exterior is important to him, but it has to be a consequence of quality of the interior spaces that he wanted to create here. And the architecture had to be subservient to the works of art. It's there to amplify your experience of the works of art. Yet at the same time, he's created such a particular atmosphere through the views out from those very large picture windows he has. The fact that the building actually sits on the riverbed, it forms part of the city's flood defences, so it makes very interesting use of quite a dramatic site.
In fact, there's a large weir on the River Calder, which is, you can see right out the window of the room we're sitting in right now. I want to go in two different directions, and I'll leave you to decide which way you want to go first. I'm interested in what's happened in terms of international recognition, national recognition for the collection and the museum. And then I also want you to talk about how the local community has responded. So you begin whichever you like.
Well, I think the wonderful thing for us was critical reception we've had has been universally positive. I mean, it's wonderful that Wakefield so regularly appeared in the national news over the first couple of months of our opening. But more important than that critical reception is how the public are engaging with the building. After all, it's the public that give the heart and soul to an organization. We had a projected annual visitor target of 150,000 for each year. And I have to say that there was quite a degree of skepticism over being able to achieve that figure. We've been open just under 4 months, we've already had 250,000 people through the doors. So it's a wonderful moment where people are voting for their feet in terms of visiting and using and spending time in the gallery. And we're already getting this early indication that people are coming from far and wide to visit the Hepworth.
So people, you see people coming from outside of the country as well?
Oh, absolutely. I think the early visitor surveys we've done have been really gratifying in getting a sense of that international reach that is going to be so important for us. And I think is indicative of how important Barbara Hepworth and Henry Moore were. It's great to have those touchstones at the core of the collection here.
Now, what are people going to see in the exhibits themselves? There's a standing collection, a permanent collection, and then you have visiting galleries too. What kinds of things are people going to see?
Well, in the first display that we have at the Hepworth Wakefield is very much concentrating on expanding and developing the story of Barbara Hepworth, how direct carving in stone and wood was always so important to her. This idea of unlocking something essential from those materials and looking at the art historical precedents and influences that weren't just about fellow British artists. One of the reasons Hepworth was such a successful and important artist was to do with the international dialogue she developed. She went often to continental Europe with her husband, the major British painter Ben Nicholson. She was in the studios of people like Brancusi, Picasso, Arp, Giacometti, and it meant she was really a vital part of the European avant-garde in the 20s and 30s, that crucial time when a new language of modernism was being developed in sculpture. And that's really something we've been at great pains to draw out in the collection displays here, to really give a sense of what's particular and British about Hepworth's work in relation to St. Ives and, of course, in relation to Yorkshire here, her home county, but also how that opened up to a dialogue with a wider international language that is so crucial. So you've got this spirit of place, particularity of place, having a relationship with something that has now become this international phenomenon we call the art world.
Now, Moore is here too. Moore is represented here too.
He is. You can't talk about Hepworth without Moore. They are inextricably linked. There were moments when there were similarities in work, but there's also a lot of major differences too. I mean, Hepworth in some ways is rather a purer, abstract, classical, pristine language. Henry Moore's had elements of surrealism in. Figure was always a hugely important part of Moore's work. So it's an interesting moment to compare and contrast the different ways in which they worked.
Now, there are some pieces of Barbara Hepworth's work you haven't laid your hands on yet. Are you scheming about that? I mean, there's a Madonna and Child in a church in St. Ives. And we've been there several times trying to find it when it's open. And it never seems to be open.
It's a wonderful piece. Absolutely. And I think that development of ongoing relationships with not only the Tate, who we have a partnership with, but with private collectors is going to be very important as we move forward as an organization. We want to be showing people new things on a regular basis. It's not having a collection that's just a static thing. You've been once and you feel you've done it. Each few months you want to feel there's always something new and exciting being brought in.
So there's a visiting collection right now, and what's coming up after that? For listeners who might need several months to plan coming here, can you give us a preview of what they might expect to be able to find?
Well, that story connected to Hepworth is never going to diminish in any way. It is about bringing new examples in to the richness of that experience of her work alive, no matter when you come to the Hepworth. So that's one important thing to emphasize. You're never going to come here and be disappointed by the fact there's hardly any Barbara Hepworth. She's always going to be a key component. But we're eager to begin exploring many of the other artists that are in the collection we inherit as an organization from the old Wakefield Art Gallery. And one of the remarkable
things... Oh, I see. So you had a collection starting out that was in a different building altogether.
Absolutely. A building that was a fraction of the size of this new one, where they could only show about 5% of the collection they'd amassed from the mid-1920s onwards. And in many ways, Wakefield had always been rather radical in terms of the avant-garde work it collected. It did buy very early work by both Hepworth and Moore at a time when I imagine the general public must have found that pretty shocking and difficult work to deal with. So on one level, we are building on a tradition that the Wakefield has always enjoyed, although it hasn't really had the public acclaim up until now.
Well, that's just a great thing. Now, I noticed a lot of school children here, and as I was coming in, they were heading to the outside to what looked like rather interesting play areas. Now, is there sort of this interaction as well between sort of inside the museum and outside the museum?
I think so. I think there's a story to be told about the building, as I'd already described, the drama of the site, the engineering feats that go into creating the building. Something about the history of the site too. We're right by some buildings that really speak of the old industrial history of Wakefield. Worsted Mill behind us from the late 19th century. There's an old water mill right in front of the gallery that's going to be the subject of future restoration work. And it's great that...
Oh, that's a building that's partly, you can see it's partly being restored now.
Well, actually, it's right in the middle of being completely covered by a contemporary artist framework. This artist is wrapping the building with his work of art, and it will do two things. One, it creates a fantastic, dramatic, large-scale work of art right on our doorstep. And two, it does protect this building from the 1790s from any further dilapidation whilst the funds are raised to get it back to its former glory. But this play between the inside and outside, I think we have found a lot of school children and families enjoying the kinds of dialogues that can be had there.
Great. Well, there are two things we need to do next to wrap up. First of all, we need a website so that people can keep track of everything that's going on here. So go ahead, Simon.
Of course, it's www.hepworthwakefield.org.
Okay. No hyphenation.
Nice straightforward one.
Okay.
www.hepworthwakefield.org.
You have to remember it's an org.
And
I'm going to chip in that this is a easy place to get to, much easier than you think. If you're in London, you can be in Wakefield in 2 hours on the train, and then it's a short taxi ride to get to the Hepworth Museum. If you're driving, it's a short distance from the M62 going east and west and from the M1 going north and south. So you have no excuse but plan on coming to the Hepworth, and I'm sure that if you ask the right people when you get here, they'll also be able to help you fill a day or two in the Wakefield area and get to understand the region more if you have a mind for that. Most importantly is this wonderful new opportunity that Simon's described. Simon, I want to thank you so much for joining on the menu today. We'll have to come back and visit in about 5 years and find out how many more of your dreams have come true. But clearly, this place is off and running with the numbers that you talked about. I think that's wonderful. And it's been a wonderful visit. So thank you so much for joining us today on the menu.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
Covering our next topic, Peter always feels rather proud because the closest landmark to the Yorkshire Sculpture Park, which we're going to talk about in just a second, is called the Hague Roundabout. Now, I don't know which of the branch of the family ever owned that, but when you get off the M1 at the intersection that will take you to Bretton Woods, to the Yorkshire Sculpture Park, if you see the sign quickly enough, if you're observant, you'll see the Hague Roundabout, and I'm sure you'll think of on the menu radio. But we're doing something really clever today, because we have, for those who know the world of baseball, a pinch hitter. Simon Wallace is going to talk about the Yorkshire Sculpture Park, another great art attraction in South Yorkshire, because unfortunately the director, Peter Murray, couldn't join us at the last minute. So since there's a connection between the two organizations, they work together anyway, Simon stepped up and said, hey, I can talk about that. So we're changing the subject to a mostly outdoor exhibit located less than a mile and a half from the M1 motorway, not more than a 20-minute drive away from the Hepworth Gallery, where of course we're talking right now. Simon, over to you.
It is a wonderful moment to have this sort of critical mass of organizations dealing with sculpture in West Yorkshire. It is vital when you come up to this bit of the world, once you've been to the Hepworth, to get over to the Yorkshire Sculpture Park. It's acres of beautiful Yorkshire rolling countryside, peppered with fantastic world-class sculptures set in really delightful grounds that make up the sculpture park. Alongside that, you've got some terrific contemporary architecture that's made up of the visitor centre, a great restaurant, cafe, and some world-class gallery spaces there for their temporary exhibitions. They tend to do one very large exhibition each year, but all of the works of art set in the sculpture park are there, come rain or shine, year in, year out. And it's Europe's most visited sculpture park. So a terrific...
Is that so? That's really remarkable. Now, if you're suggesting that the Hepworth is a better place, you do the two, you should start at the Hepworth. If we asked Peter Murray, would he say the opposite?
You could have a great experience no matter where you start, actually.
So it really doesn't matter.
It really doesn't matter. You'd expect me as the director of the Hepworth to get you to come to the Hepworth first. But I think what's wonderful is the two organizations have a terrific dialogue anyway. It does create that critical mass where you will come away with such a rich understanding of 20th century and contemporary sculpture from an engagement with both organizations. It's something very, very special and unique in the world.
The Sculpture Park is itself a growing entity, right? It really was quite small for a number of years. And then now they've added a lot of additional things.
Absolutely. The remarkable new architecture there is always a joy to go to. But I go often as a visitor above and beyond the professional connection I've got. And it's blissful to see works of art of such quality in this wonderful outdoor environment. And actually, you know, very interesting relationship to us, where, of course, we're an indoor museum primarily. So a great combination of experiences to be had.
So if you were there 10 years ago, you'd be long overdue to go back and find out how much they've done in that period of time?
Undoubtedly. I mean, year in, year out, the quality of the exhibitions is absolutely world class. But I think it is an experience that you'd be really surprised, even if you hadn't been for say 3 or 4 years. It's really transformed into something quite remarkable. It's absolutely exquisite, and I think one of the crucial places in the world to go to see sculpture of that quality in such a beautiful environment.
Now, who are some of the Henry Moore is represented, of course. Who are some of the other artists who are represented in the sculpture park?
Barbara Hepworth is also a crucial part of that mix. At the moment, they've got a wonderful temporary exhibition by somebody called Kwame Plensa, one of the major figurative sculptors of our time, and the show looks absolutely wonderful. Their next show is going to be a major sculptural show by Miro, so it'll be fascinating to get a sense of Miro's relationship through to Hepworth and Moore. And artists like Anthony Caro.
Miro, they're probably going to be bringing over some pieces from the wonderful facility in Barcelona.
Absolutely.
There's a magnificent Miro Academy or Institute, I forget what it's called, in the Montjuïc section of Barcelona, which we've seen and which many of you who are art fans have probably seen. So some of that will be represented in the show?
I'd be very surprised if it wasn't. They really have a reputation for curating just such well put together and well thought through shows. But it is the beauty of the context that makes it feel unique. You're not just going to an identikit museum. You're really getting a sense of what sculpture in the landscape can do, and the power of that relationship is so important.
And a big part of the attraction and the reason they're able to attract all these special exhibits is just because they have such a good foundation collection, so they have a lot of respect around the world.
Absolutely. I mean, they've really built a very important relationship with some of the major collectors and institutions in the world, and that reputation is built and built. But in terms of experiencing art, being able to walk, you could spend an entire day there easily. There is so much land to enjoy walking through, and you'll get something great to eat and drink there too. Very crucial part of keeping your energy.
Because after all, there isn't a lot in... It sounds like Bretton Woods might be a big place, but it's really very tiny. And I do have a suggestion for listeners who are not Northwestern Europeans. This is a place where it rains, and the ground can get quite soggy. You're walking through the grass, so stout shoes are recommended. And if there's any doubt in your mind, bring an umbrella. because it's really important to see the work as it's laid out, just as Simon was saying. And their website, do you know it off by heart? Okay, then I will I'll add it on afterwards so that people can go there and check out the dates of some of these upcoming special events. But listeners, you have no excuse not to go by there because it's almost on the way. As I leave here today, I'm actually going to approach the A638 intersection with the M1, pass the Hague roundabout, and wave as I do that. And you should all do the same. And I thank you so much for pinch hitting for us today, Simon. And it's just been just a pleasure to meet you and to know that the world of modern art is really strong and vibrant in South Yorkshire, that which used to be West Yorkshire.
Still is West Yorkshire.
Oh, is it still West Yorkshire?
Yes,
yes. See, I get the writings mixed up.
Yes, so I think since the demise of people using the writings term, yes, it is West Yorkshire.
So there is now a West Yorkshire and an East Yorkshire and a North Yorkshire.
Absolutely.
They're just not called writings anymore.
That's exactly it.
I see. Okay, well, thank you very much for clarifying that for me. Just in case you're wondering, listeners, there were three, and that's why they were called ridings, because they were thirdings. But then we're getting off the subject here. Come to Yorkshire. The people at Yorkshire.com will be delighted. The people at the Hepworth will be delighted. The people at the Sculpture Park will be delighted. And the best of all, you'll know that you've had a wonderful time and a rich cultural experience.
There's one more thing I would like to add in terms of your visit here. I think it's so important that once the Hepworth and the Yorkshire Sculpture Park are being experienced, it's well worth your time going to Leeds, the major city in West Yorkshire, just up the road, 10-15 minutes up the road from both the Sculpture Park and from the Hepworth, and to visit the Henry Moore Institute in Leeds and Leeds Art Gallery. They're actually attached to one another, quite distinct institutions, but that's the last part of the triangle of organizations dealing with major works of 20th century and contemporary sculpture. So important to get up to Leeds too for a much more urban experience, but one that is really going to be rewarded by a wonderful collection at Leeds Art Gallery and some important work.
I'm so glad. That's a great segue, because people who come to Yorkshire should visit Leeds anyway. It's the shopping capital of Yorkshire. It's almost, to me, the shopping capital of England. There is so much fine shopping there, but fine art should be, of course, the beginning of your reason. And then after that, you can walk around and spend money if you'd like. Simon, thank you so much for adding that to the conversation. We won't have time to go there this trip, but we'll make sure we go there the next time we're in Leeds.
Thanks, Peter. Look forward to seeing you all here.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and isn't it nice to be somewhere where everyone knows your name, Hague? Which is an old, good old Yorkshire name.
Yeah, you don't have to spell it out for people.
Is that a song, by the way?
Yes, it is.
Song?
No, it was the theme music for a TV program. I think it was the TV program Cheers.
Oh, I thought there was a Ringo Starr song about.
Well, there might have been, but the one that, where everybody knows your name is the series about the bar.
Oh, okay.
With Ted Danson in it, called Cheers.
That's what
you're thinking of. And thinking of bars, I guess we can stretch that to say we're thinking of dining establishments, because you always need to have the opportunity to refresh the inner man. And there's a wonderful place to do that in the heart of a beautiful scenic area of my home county of Yorkshire called the Yorkshire Dales in Wharfedale, a magnificent property which is really a huge farm owned by the Duke of Devonshire and his family for 600 or 700 years or so, I guess. But they've reinvented it as a luxury place to stay with two wonderful restaurants, both of which we enjoyed.
They moved to bigger digs.
Well, the Duke of Duke of Devonshire moved back to Chatsworth House in Derbyshire, but I guess he has plenty of places to live. But we're talking here about fine dining options in the Yorkshire Dales at the Devonshire Arms, the Burlington, and the Brasserie, and we talked to Chef Steve Smith about both of them.
Well, we had an absolutely scrumptious meal last night, and it's a delight to be able to talk to the chef who made that possible, Chef Stephen Smith, who we were instructed to call Steve. Welcome to On the Menu, Steve.
Good morning. Thank you.
We have a lot of ground to cover because we haven't met before.
No, not at all. I think this is your first, well, it's your second time here, isn't it? The first time dining with myself.
Chef, yeah.
Indeed.
Now, just a brief bit on your background. You're born, you're native Yorkshireman or not?
No, I'm not a native Yorkshireman. I was born in Warwickshire, down in the Midlands, but a lot of my family was from the Yorkshire area. A lot of them still live in Halifax and the surrounding areas. So I suppose to a certain extent it's quite nice to be in Yorkshire, in all fairness. It's a wonderful place to be, and we've got some fantastic produce
up here. Products, yes. Now, you did have some formal training, but you essentially learned on the job from working in some fairly prestigious kitchens.
Yeah, I think I was fairly fortunate. I think everywhere that I've worked since I was 18, 19 have all held, you know, one or two Michelin stars. So in that sense, I've worked in some very good restaurants, but I don't think that always necessarily translates to being able to produce it in your own kitchen.
But you yourself have a reputation for being a Michelin star gatherer, right?
I suppose I've had a star for about 10 to 12 years now, and in fairness, everywhere I've worked as a head chef, we've managed to be awarded a star. So in that respect, we looked on quite favourably, and we've done very well. But it's also a reflection of the people that I've managed to have working for me as well, really.
Well, now, we're at the Devonshire Arms, and they had lost a star when they lost their last chef. Then it came back very quickly once you could assume this job.
Yeah, I think Michael left in October. It must be sort of four and a half years ago now, I think, Michael left. The star was then taken away in the following January. I started in April, and then we got the star back straight away in the next guide back in January. So
Now that really says a lot about...
So that's pretty quick. And I think really it's because we managed to find a groove and we managed to make the food consistent. But at the same time, I was cooking food that I knew well, using some great ingredients up here. So I think realistically it wasn't unreasonable to think that we could do it. It's just great when you do it though.
Well, now, if someone's coming here to dinner, do you do lunch or is it just dinner?
No, we open for dinner from Tuesday to Sunday night, and the only lunch that we open at present is Sunday lunch.
Okay.
And Sunday lunch is it's just a little bit simpler than dinner, really.
Okay. And you say you have your groove. What might potential diners expect that groove to be? What kind of food do you do?
Well, I suppose the food that we do is always ingredients-based, but I suppose what we try and do is we cook fairly classically, and I suppose that would be either in an English sense or a French sense with ingredient combinations. And then we just try and put a little bit of acidity, a little bit of texture, and some, a little bit of fun in some of the dishes as well, in all fairness. I think to get a true reflection of the style of food, you're always better off eating one of tasting or the
which
prestige
we did.
Menus, which are the longer menus. And then obviously we have the a la carte menu as well.
So yeah, I got such a kick out of the onion and licorice velouté with a hen's egg and toasted rye. It was like a miniature gourmet breakfast. It had a lot of humor to it, I thought.
Yeah, I think it's one of those dishes where I think it sets up the meal quite nicely because it's a little bit of fun. There's quite a lot going on, but although there are some strange flavors in there with the licorice and the rye, they're flavors I suppose you can feel and you can have any part of the day, really. And I suppose people, that it's accessible. Although there's a little twist and there's a strange flavour combination.
Oh, licorice is very popular right now in the States. I don't know about here.
It's not so popular over here, but one of the reasons that we use it is because there's a massive amount of it grown in Wakefield.
Really?
Which is then used for Yorkshire licorice over in Pontefract.
Yeah, they make
traditional sort of hard, sticky, sweet.
Yeah.
And we prefer the flavour of the root, which goes into the soup.
The best risotto I ever had was in Italy, and it was at Le Calandre, and it was saffron risotto with shaved licorice right from the root.
Yeah.
from the south of Italy,
Calabria. From a particular place in Calabria, and we understand from talking to someone from that region that apparently Queen Elizabeth II is very fond of
licorice.
Calabrian licorice.
Fantastic.
She's a standing order with licorice
sort of
Calabria.
We sort of thought she liked cereal and toast, but apparently she's a huge fan of this particular product.
Brilliant.
Now, I had a question. The course we had with the langoustine and the cockles, I couldn't see aster and purslane. Now, I know what purslane is, but I didn't see any in that dish. So is it sea purslane?
Yeah, it's sea purslane. I mean, it's basically that all the vegetables on that dish are coastal sea herbs that grow on the west coast.
Yeah, I mean, it was citrusy, like garden variety purslane, yeah. But it looked different.
Yeah, no, it's just got a completely different look to it. They're really small leaves, and they are quite punchy, so you don't need to use a lot of them.
It was delicious. I also loved the Limousine veal. Explain that dish. This was really wonderful.
We use Limousine veal sweetbreads just because they're absolutely fantastic quality. And really, it's a
fair... They're French, right?
Yeah, French. They're paired really with sort of autumnal flavours to a certain extent. We've got some butternut squash, which we decaramelise and a little bit of brown butter and add lemon juice to it, so it's not... It sort of brings out a little bit of the sweetness, but it still leaves a little bit of acidity in there. The veal sweetbread's roasted, and we serve that with some chanterelle mushrooms, some pumpkin seeds. But we just finished the sauces with a little bit of tonka bean, which just helps to freshen the flavour of the veal.
Tonka bean. That must be what we call pepitas.
Possibly. I think that they're originally from Venezuela. I do know that they are banned in some areas of America because they can, used in large quantities, they can be hallucinogenic.
Oh, nice. I wish I'd known that last
night. So we could have made you a cup of tea for breakfast this morning before we did the interview.
Okay.
Could have been quite an interesting interview.
Now, of course, your scallops were divine.
Yeah,
now,
no,
what inspired this combination with smoked eel and truffle?
I suppose some of the dishes aren't always put together because of the flavour combinations in terms of the way that you would normally think. Sometimes we sort of look at different areas of flavour. So we might look at fats or sugars or acids or smoke, and then look at theme throughout the ingredients that should bring them together. And in the sense on this dish, it's actually they all actually contain the same type of sugars.
Oh,
so they should work quite well.
Thought of that.
And then we buy the scallops from the west coast of Scotland. They're only hand-dived. We have deliveries in 3 days a week, so they are absolutely spanking fresh.
And not only that, perfectly cooked.
And they're perfect.
How easy it is to wreck a scallop, and you did a perfect job of it.
And I suppose there's a little bit of acidity there from the apple. There's a little bit of earthiness from the celeriac and from the truffle. And then there's a little bit of smoke, which sort of brings the two flavours together from the smoked eel. You've got to be quite careful, because you don't need too much of the eel or the truffle, otherwise it just puts it out of balance.
You're really thoughtful.
We are. We do try to be fairly thoughtful, and I suppose we've gotten to a point where the dishes, they're well-trialed and versed before they see light of day on a menu, and sometimes it takes us up to 2 or 3 weeks to get a particular element of a dish right, in the sense of it can be done consistently by the guys in the kitchen.
Several dishes on this trip with pressings. Is that coming back?
I suppose it's a traditional thing that's starting to come back a little bit. I like them because you're able to show, for me, it's showing off a good skill, really. You know, there are various elements that go into, it's really just a new word for a tureen, but they're dishes that hopefully that when you go into them, because of the way that they're put together, they can sort of give you different flavour sensations depending on what part you're eating at any one time. I find them interesting from that point of view. I suppose they're good for us during service because it's literally slice onto to a plate. It keeps, it's a good dish to have for service on a busy night in one of these menus. Essentially, it's not too difficult to plate up. All of the work has gone into it beforehand.
And another thing is jellies are making a big revival. We're having a big revival, and you seem to master those beautifully well.
We've got a few going on. The canapé that everybody receives in just before they start their meal is a very simple jelly. It's just equal quantities of cucumber, fennel, and apple, which we juice, and we'll serve that with crème fraîche and confit tuna. So I suppose it's an elaborate canapé, but I suppose it sets people up for a good meal. You know, you're not expecting it. It's maybe a little more elaborate, a few things on bread or a bit of toast or a gougère. And so for that sense, we find it because we're able to play around with it a little bit. There's more than one. It's going on. I suppose it can go on quite nicely.
Well, you know, your presentations are knockout too, I must say. You're very artistic, but blow it all out of the ballpark was, I guess that's an American expression, to knock it out of the ballpark. But anyway, it was this Angus beef presentation, which was smoked beef, sirloin, and braised cheek with onion, nettle, risotto, which was brilliant green, snails, and red wine. I mean, I read that and I thought, what could this be?
Yeah.
And then I adored this dish.
Yeah. It's really a play on a traditional English dish, in all fairness, although there's an element of a risotto in there. Braised beef and nettles was a dish that's sort of been used and eaten in York for a considerable amount of time. We've just sort of played around really with the concept of it. Onions work brilliantly with beef. The smokiness of the sirloin adds to that sort of unctuous texture of the cheek, so you've got two textures going on. And then you've got some acidity and almost sort of oystery flavour in the nettles and a little bit of acidity in the onions.
Oh, is
to
that
cut
what
it.
I keep trying to figure out what nettles really
it's
taste
sort of,
like.
It's almost a sort of parsley, oystery kind of flavour. And oysters work brilliantly with beef, so it's quite good. A nice combination,
and
really.
And it came in this dough the smoke.
Yeah, we have a glass cloche which fits perfectly over that particular dish, and we fill it with a little bit of smoke, so when you actually lift it off, there's a little bit of theatre there, and you actually get the aroma of the smoke.
A brilliantly presented dish.
Yeah, it's a remarkable thing when everybody in the dining room is having that dish at almost the same time. The whole room sort of, you can't say it comes alive with smoke.
No,
things come with smoke, it becomes that way.
Yeah, no, we have to be careful with that one, because if too many people take cloches off at the same time, we sometimes set off the fire alarms. It's something that we've learned not to do anymore.
That's
funny. But it could be quite interesting on a Saturday. It's a little bit twitchy if there's a few going out at the same time.
So weekends are busy times at the Devonshire Arms.
Yeah, no, the restaurant's generally full from Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night. Sunday night is a great night for us as well. And I suppose, like most restaurants outside of major cities, Tuesdays and Wednesdays sometimes can be difficult to have a full restaurant. But I think in general, the numbers that we do, we're pretty happy with.
This is a destination restaurant, isn't it? I mean, people don't accidentally drive on the little country road.
No, not at all. I mean, you don't just sort of think, we'll go and have a little bite at Burlington.
Mention that is the name, and I was going to ask you, why is it called the Burlington, the name of the fine dining restaurant?
I mean, it's named after the Duke's son. I mean, it's the Duke's son is always loyal to Burlington. It was named after him, and a lot of the artwork that's in the Burlington is personal to Burlington.
I thought that was probably what it was.
Now, we should mention the cheese cart, but it's a selection of artisan cheeses. Now, I guess you call it the cheese trolley. Are those local?
The vast majority of them on there. We have, at any one point, we can have up to about 27 or 28 cheeses on there. What you'll find is around about 18 of them will be English. Of those 18, 15 of them are from this area and our surrounding areas. And then there's a few French on there, and the rest are from other parts of England.
Now, you have a whole selection of desserts. Now, Peter had the name I love, the Chocolate Mayhem. It had everything. It had caramel, it had lime.
Caramel, lime, nuts.
Gold leaf.
I suppose it's just an extravagant celebration of chocolate, really. And I suppose it's a chocolate lover's delight. Anybody that loves chocolate is really going to get on with that and really enjoy it.
The ordinary tasty menu has three desserts on it, and true to form, didn't have any of them. I said, I said, Chef, you can send out one, and this was the one that he chose.
Love the cheese roll. Now, do you make your own bread too?
We make all of our own breads. They're made every day. It's quite a complicated scenario for us, because we make bread for everything. We make all of the cheese breads, we make all of the breads in the restaurant, we make all the breads that we use for toasts at breakfast. So it's a big job for the guys in pastry every morning, but everything's made absolutely fresh every day, and I suppose we enjoy making bread. It's very therapeutic.
Now, one of the fun things about dining in Burlington is that one of those true people you can call a character, whose name is Nigel Fairclough.
Oh, I was just going to ask who's
who's the cellar master.
Nigel, the cellar master, is quite unique.
He's also a master waiter, busboy, just humming around the dining room at all times.
He recognized us from 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's great, isn't it?
The important thing to bear in mind is that the wine program is immense. The wine program should have an interview all of its own, because it's such a special program. But the best part about what Nigel does is he'll take all the stress away from it. If you say, I'm looking for a wine like this sort of budget, he'll just take over. And he turned out that he served the same red wine with the Angus beef to the table next to us as we had, and we all thought it was delightful. It was a Sangiovese with some Cabernet and Merlot added from a name vineyard nobody'd ever heard of in the Chianti Classico region.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that he can help do. And we shouldn't close this without saying there's another dining option here at the Devonshire Arms for those people who are not looking for a formal 6 to 9 course menu. And that's where we had dinner on Monday night, the Brasserie. And they have a separate chef and a separate kitchen, but under your supervision?
No, it's completely separate.
Completely separate,
okay. Dan Field is the chef in the Brasserie, and he has complete control and is allowed to do his own style of food down there, and I suppose it complements what we do up here. It's obviously not everybody that stays or is at the Devonshire want to eat every night in the Burlington, and it's a great option to have, and it has its own unique following also.
I'm sure it does, because the food is much simpler, but it's also excellent in its terms of its preparation and its presentation.
Yeah, no, indeed.
One of the neat things you can do from there is look out the window across the street, and there you have the secret to some of your success, which is the chef's garden.
Yeah, no, we've got quite a decent area, in fairness, that we use for vegetables.
So how many gardeners?
There's one gardener that looks after it. He does a good job in there. And we take quite a bit of stuff out there, so it will provide most of our herbs during the summer, our salads. It's been fantastic for tomatoes this year. At the moment, we're taking out beetroots that we use on our venison dish. We're taking
about
five varieties of beetroot in there that we take. We've got fennel, we've got artichokes,
like,
and Jerusalem artichokes coming through.
Spherified beet juice.
Yeah, no, that's, I suppose it's a little, acts as a really good cleanser, that beetroot sphere,
like
to be
it.
Fair. A little bit of verjuice. But a lot of the veg that we use, we are fortunate in the fact that we can just go over the road and pick it as we need it on a day-to-day basis. So it's great for that, and it can't beat freshly picked vegetables. They've got so much more flavour than anything that you get from suppliers or supermarkets. It's great.
So all in all, this is a wonderful dining destination. It's also a wonderful scenic country destination that's very accessible. The drive to get here from the Leeds Bradford Airport is how long? Not very long.
It's not very long at all. It's about 15 minutes. It's a fairly simple route. You come straight through Ilkley. You're here. But I think the great thing is once you're actually through Ilkley, you just sort of see the countryside expand out, and you go from seeing houses and shops, and all of a sudden you're in rural England to a certain extent.
Yeah, and you are, thanks to the fact that this is an estate that's controlled by the Duke of Devonshire family. And it's really a giant farm with a guest house on it.
So
it just also happens to have a nice restaurant because the Duke gets a lot of guests.
And so, you know, for those people that love walking, there's some great routes and some great walks to be had. You know, so it's not just, there's a little bit for everybody. If that's what if they like spending time outside, it's ideal.
And for our transatlantic listeners, of course, we're transatlantic ourselves. It's a little more than an hour from the Manchester International Airport, which is served by many more overseas airlines than Leeds Bradford.
Yeah, no, indeed.
In fact, sadly, that's our next destination shortly after this interview. But Steve, it was a pleasure to be your guest last evening and to have the chance to talk to you today. Anne, do you have any final thoughts?
No, I just think that I'm very impressed with how thoughtful and lucid this whole menu is. And I loved the dishes individually and as a whole tasting menu.
Oh, thank you. I'm pleased that you've enjoyed your stay, and it's been great to meet you both.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Of course, all of our travels are filled with a lot of good nourishment, we can refer to it as, right?
Yes, we can do that.
But what's up next?
Well, what's up next is some nourishment, but also a wonderfully convenient place to stay in one of the most historic cities in the whole of the world, the medieval city of York, which was the Roman capital of the north of England and the Danish capital when they controlled England, the home of the Archbishop of York, the second man in the Anglican Church in England, a place so steeped with history.
And
it's
university.
Just absolute, it's steeped in history. The university is relatively modern. Our niece Helen went there, but it was a foundation of the modern era rather than the historical era. But there's a whole lot going on in York, and what better place to stay than the Dean Court Hotel, which is a very you can't even call it a stone's throw. It's perhaps 15 meters away from the entrance to the wonderful York Minster. So we had a chance to talk to the general manager of the hotel where we stayed, and here's our interview with him. On the Menu hasn't been to York for a long time, since before we were running the program, but we're here in Peter's home county today and talking to David Brooks, who's the general manager of the Dean Court Hotel, which has to be, David, just about the most perfectly situated hotel one could ever stay in, because one of the wonders of medieval Europe is how many yards away?
About 10 or 15 yards, just literally across the narrow street.
And just in case you don't know that, it's the famous York Minster, which is a wonderful medieval edifice, but one that's had a very interesting history in recent years, because there was at one point, I believe, a danger that it might fall down.
Well, absolutely. The somewhat unknown fact, and whenever I think a lot of the guides, of which my wife is one, they're always taking delight in asking people what they think holds it together. And it is air, as you wish. The bricks are literally there with no mortar or anything to hold them together. So that in itself is quite
that's in the Minster. That's in the Minster.
The Minster itself is held together by nothing but the bricks on top of each other and a bit of air in between.
But there were some problems with the foundations, I believe.
Yes, indeed. Funny enough, I was here when they celebrated the 10th anniversary of what was a bit of a miracle, and no pun intended, in the way in which they found a way of propping up the North Tower. It was in danger of sinking, and the very simple way to explain how they managed to stabilize it and move it back into its position before obviously pouring concrete and everything in was balloons. They literally put massive balloons underneath, inflated them, and then filled the gaps.
Okay, and then they filled the space, and then they filled the space with concrete. Lots of concrete.
Indeed. And you can go down and see there are these enormous supports with the most enormous nuts and bolts you could ever imagine. Yeah, you can actually see the end result.
They made a number of interesting archaeological discoveries too.
Absolutely.
But let's come back to where we are just at this very moment, because I'm looking out the window of the Ellen MacLeod suite, I think, at the hotel here, the Dean Court Hotel, and I'm looking at the Minster and people walking by, lots of tourists.
Cause yes, indeed.
Indeed, New York is a tourist city. I was walking around the streets last evening and there were lots and lots of accents, rather different than mine.
Very much so, yes.
And David's.
Yes.
But this building itself is historical.
Indeed it is. It was built in the 1850s and originally for the clergy of the Minster. And whilst our most recent renovations and modernising the interior discovered a few little bits and pieces, they were mostly from sort of 40 or 50 years ago, little matchboxes tucked behind walls and so on. But the origins were quite fascinating. There are many tales of underground tunnels that sort of led shortcuts so that a certain of the clergy during their training could escape into the city. But I think that's just a rather amusing imagination on somebody's part. But that was the origin of the building.
Interesting. But it's a group of adjacent buildings.
Yes, it is.
They're not all the same building.
No, certainly not. The main area, the main part of the building, as I said, is 1850s. And if you stand at the front from across the road and look at the front, you'll see that a proportion of it is much lower in profile, but also of a different era altogether. And that is on the site of a medieval cottage, and it was allegedly a Georgian building, originally a guest house before it became part of the hotel in the mid-80s. But the funny thing is that when the joining up of the two properties was on the go and the builders were knocking through walls and so on, they suddenly realised that the front, the whole facade, was starting to fall, and it was discovered that it was a fake Georgian facade. So, yes,
okay.
So this face started to fall. And it's rather timely that you're here now, Peter, because only a few months ago, a fairly elderly gentleman came into the foyer and asked to see me. And I presumed he was a customer. But no, in his possession he had a very faded sepia photo and a little bit of paperwork. And it was he that was in charge of the company that actually did the renovation, and he showed me a picture of the facade in its almost prone state. And having heard this story so many times over the years that I've been here, it was really, really interesting to listen to him. And, of course, he said at the time, you know, he was in danger of incurring a massive amount of costs to put this right.
Well, it's an amazing property because of the history surrounding it. But you have gone to great lengths to modernize the hotel.
Yes.
It has Wi-Fi throughout the building. It has a resource at the front desk whose name is Philippe. Philippe on the air. Thank you for your help today in helping us to debug the power problem, without which we would not be able to have this interview. So you're catering to the business traveler to York, but also the tourist traveler?
Very much so. Tourism is the majority, a significant majority. But yes, the businesses that are close by in the city, I'm glad to say, also book their people in here. But tourism, and as you mentioned earlier, many, many accents, many countries, including your own, are frequent visitors to our door.
Now, I should admit on the air that what has happened, David, is I've lost my accent because I was born and raised a Yorkshireman, and I guess you continue to be one.
It's just that I've been away. Well, it's cunningly disguised.
For more than 50 years, I've been somewhere else, but I felt very much like it was coming home to come here. And this is a really exciting tourist destination for those people who have a mind to history.
Very much so, yes. It oozes history. It's a very compact city. You can walk from one side to the other in about 15 minutes, unless, of course, you're distracted by almost every pace. There is something to see. When we first came here 18 years ago, I was not familiar with York. I'm from the south. And we came to see the hotel that we might run. My longing to come to York, knowing it as a city, was one thing. But I was absolutely amazed, because in the few days that we first came, walking around, at every moment there is an architectural element of beauty. It is remarkable.
It truly is remarkable. One of the most remarkable things is that the medieval city walls are intact, penetrated in several places by gates, which for reasons that remain a mystery to me are called bars.
Yes, indeed.
But the walls are there, and they're not so evident, because this is a city on a plain rather than a city on a hill. But there is a medieval intactness about this place that's really genuine.
Absolutely. Nearly three quarters of the complete walls are still there. They are used, walked on, and by tourists every day. There is a new association called Friends of York Walls, which is destined to improve and give the walls a much higher profile as an iconic attraction. And that's long overdue and much deserved. But it's a real pleasure to walk around the whole of the city. But we in York, and having been here 18 years, I'm almost entitled to say we owe a lot to William Etty, the York-born artist. It was he that stopped the council of the day in the 18th century from knocking down the walls.
Oh, so was even suggested they be removed?
Oh, yes. Knocking down buildings is not something that is a sort of recent threat, if you like, to our heritage. It's been happening for centuries, and William Etty, thank goodness for all of us now, saved the day and saved the walls.
I think as Americans, on the menu's resident country, probably leads the world in removing things long before their lifespan is over. But it's interesting that it was happening as far back as that here in the city of York. Now, we're limited in time today, and I'm going to mention three attractions that I think we're going to see, and then I'm going to ask you to agree, did we make a good choice, and then perhaps suggest a couple more. And then beyond that, listeners, you just have to come for a third or a fourth additional day in order to be able to see all the other things which are here. But I think first off, I've been to York several times when I was much younger. We've never been to the Castle Museum, which is a reconstruction of Victorian York.
Absolutely.
In a little street. Then we're planning on going to the Jorvik Viking Centre. Because lost in history, and most people don't know this, is that the city of York was at one time the capital of England when England was ruled by the Danes.
Absolutely.
So a lot of archaeology, really, I think there was interest in archaeology. It seems to me that it came from the time when the Minster was being reinforced, that before that there was really no emphasis on Danish York. And then, of course, we're going on to the famous Minster, because it's not just a British landmark. this is a medieval landmark across the whole of Europe, I think.
It's the largest Gothic construction in the Northern Hemisphere, yes, okay. And you're dead right to include that.
So those are the three we play. Now, what are a couple more?
Well, you've got so many places. In the city there are, and I think for a broad span of interest, there is in London, the York Dungeon. So the Minster is just the best place to see. I think for two others, one cannot fail to mention the National Railway Museum. That's achieved world status. And I must emphasize that you don't need to be interested in steam or steam engines at all. It is the most family orientated, wonderful museum and something
it's
for everybody.
It's really funny. I remember when that was first getting started. And it was just like an adjunct to the train station.
To the railway, that's right.
And so before it became the real thing. And the most impressive thing about it, listeners, if you've never been close to one of these magnificent locomotives, they are so enormous and powerful.
They are phenomenal.
They're absolutely worth an attempt to go see. And then there's an iconic site just outside the city of York.
Yes, indeed.
Which is well worth a visit.
Indeed. And this would be second on my extras list. Castle Howard. Some of your listeners may know Brideshead Revisited as the TV program.
It was very popular.
Exactly,
in the
yes.
States.
Well, of course, that is
in fact,
drawing.
It was popular around the world. Where,
indeed.
Where There are probably Italian listeners who listen to
yes,
to
that's wonderful. So that's drawing thousands and thousands of people and has done over the years. It's the most beautiful bit. It's only about 20 minutes drive from here. And so just that little bit stretching York's boundaries, that's wonderful.
Now, one of the interesting things about York, we came here by car, mm-hmm. which is not the easiest thing to do. It's really curious. You have to get within about 6 miles of York before there's a direction that says
yes,
this is where it is.
I know.
Really, really kind of a puzzling thing.
That's a unique situation, a unique circumstance, and it happens elsewhere. And it's all to do with the ports. Where there is a port will take a little bit of priority. That's what I've been told.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And the other wonderful way to get here is to come here on the train. Because York is smack on the main railway line between London and Edinburgh, Scotland.
Indeed.
Just about halfway between
the two
cities. So, and although the train station is outside the city walls, because I guess they didn't want to bring the railway lines through the walls, it's very convenient, very close by. And of course, when you come to York, there's only one place to stay. It's the Dean's Court Hotel. And Paul, is there a direct website for the hotel?
Yes, there is.
Go ahead.
It's Dean Court, all one word, DEANCOURT -york.co.uk.
So don't forget the hyphen and don't do as I did and put an S on the end of
no,
Dean's.
No S.
So it's Dean Court.
Dean Court.
Hyphen.
That's right.
Hotel.
And we're part of the Best Western chain, and they are privately owned and independently run hotels.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And we're going to have a beautiful day out. It's breezy, but it's not raining. So we're looking forward to the pleasure of being in York. And we thank you so much for your hospitality here at the hotel, David.
My pleasure. It's great to have you with us.
Well, there you have it. I think somebody once wrote a book or a movie or something that said, you can't go home again. Well, here's evidence that you can. And not only that, some very modern reasons why you might want to. So off you go to Yorkshire, have a wonderful time, and tell them that Peter and Anne sent you.
And don't forget the pudding.
And don't forget the pudding, and until next week.
Bye-bye.